Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke. One of the things that I found scummy was the Stand Up for WWE campaign during Linda McMahon's awful Senate run, asking us to defend them for some of the shit they did. Especially since after we stood up, they told us to sit back down who weren't 6'2 and 240 pounds.
I'm Kieran O'Rourke, and this week I finally get to say, Steve Austin, Chris Jericho, Dave Meltzer, Brian Alvarez, you boys took one hell of a beating.
I'm G. John Chase, and apparently after Raw, some fucking nobody who won Tough Enough thought it'd be a good idea to insult the social outcast. If you manage to make it to the main roster, and let's see if you can achieve anything more than a hashtag social jobber, dickhead.
I'm Carl Jones. Members of Parliament have debated on whether or not to ban Donald Trump from the United Kingdom. Don McLean has learnt that you can drink too much whiskey and rye. And a special someone turned 15 this week, Pat Patterson and
Mel Phillips,
were disappointed to learn that the 15-year-old was Wikipedia.
And I'm Matt Holt, and my presence here tonight is to remind you all that the Squared Circle Gazette has a deeper roster than WWE.
This is the panel for the 69th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear part two of our shows on wrestling's scummiest moments next. Hello everyone, and welcome to the 69th edition of the, yes, award-winning Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke, alongside Kieran O'Rourke.
Evening.
Carl Jones.
Guten Tag.
G. John Chase.
Hans Booby, I'm your white knight.
And back with us again, Matt Holt.
Hello again, everybody. Happy New Year.
And we are back this week for part two of wrestling's scummiest moments. We did the first installment of this show about 2 weeks ago, so you can go back to squaredcirclegazette.com where we archive every single show and check that one out. It talks about a lot of controversial scummy moments there. The Benoit tribute show, Over the Edge, Muhammad Hassan, Fritz Von Erich in general. A lot of dodgy stuff was talked about on the previous episode. And of course, last week we also did the Monday Night War timeline for 1998. So for those of you who might have missed a couple of weeks, then you can check that out at squaredcirclegazette.com. And before we talk about scummy moments today, as we alluded to there off the top, I want to give a quick thank you to everybody at the UK Fan Forum who nominated and voted for Squared Circle Gazette Radio as the best wrestling podcast of 2015. With some stiff competition, beating Steve Austin in the poll by a cunt hair, as he would say himself. So very, very proud of that, and a big thank you to everybody who made that possible. We will not gloat about it for the rest of the year. But moving along now to Wrestling's Scummiest Moments Part 2. So much to discuss. We had so much feedback on the last episode that we had to kind of carry this over two separate shows. We're going to get to as much as we can today. So we're going to kick it off with some quickfire ones from CS from Pro Wrestling Only, who says, first of all, Jerry Lawler ranting about Jake the Snake's alcoholism during their feud, which culminated in Lawler hitting Jake with a bottle of whiskey and pouring it all over him. Heck, you could probably devote an entire podcast to scummy Lawler angles that didn't draw money. After the stuff we talked about on the last podcast, including the Melanie Pillman interview that I didn't mention before, does this one rank up there for you, or is this kind of a little less offensive?
Didn't offend me personally, but I think it's really distasteful when you've got a guy who's vulnerable, like Jake, as scummy as Jake is himself. It's pretty a shitty thing to do to the guy, so...
I'd agree with that line on principle, but the fact that Jake during this period wasn't exactly hitched to the wagon, let's say.
He was trying to be.
Yeah, so he told certain people.
Jake, during the same angle, exploiting a religion by acting like a born-again Christian, which he wasn't and isn't.
Makes my case for me, thank you.
That revelation to the yellow snake card.
Oh, God.
Stone Cold pouring beer down alcoholic Scott Hall's throat. Again, along the same lines here, I don't know if people recall this, but what was the medication Scott Hall was on? Yeah, Antabuse, right? That was the deal. And Austin was poured real beer all over Scott Hall, which made him throw up, allegedly.
Yeah, I can remember literally seeing exactly that at a house show at the NEC in Birmingham. And I just remember thinking at the time, this isn't even televised, you know, is this really... And even, like, you know, down to Austin was, like, putting beers on the apron, and Hall would, like, creep down the aisle, like Pink Panther style, to try and get them, and then Austin would turn around. It was just insane, you know, really. A guy, again, vulnerability comes back to it. And I think what makes it such an awkward grey area in wrestling is it's exploitation in the worst sense, but you just know these guys are lining up to be part of it and saying, I'll do it, you know, fine. And Austin doing it then was no new thing, really, you know, with Hall's career had been sort of for years teetering on this, yeah. So
I don't think he helped your argument there, Holty, because I would have fully agreed with you right up until you use the line Scott Hall creeps down like the Pink Panther. Now I love it.
Yeah, I agree with that.
They made a joke of it in their first promo that night, No Way Out, when he was talking about having a beer with the boys, and Nash and Hogan just looked at him and wagged their finger and shook their head.
But yeah, if the guy's actually legitimately trying and he's on a medicine that you know what the reaction's going to be, it's a little bit spiteful to do it. But then, this is the kind of thing, Vince does this, he tests guys, because remember, the Eddie Guerrero was in the same position when he did the angle, if anybody remembers, when he did the karaoke in the bar with Austin, which is a fucking horrible segment, but they did the angle because they're in the bar, where they had Eddie, they placed him at the bar next to a beer bottle, and Eddie's theory was that Vince was testing him, like, okay, in this environment, we're going to put a beer right next to you, are you going to fuck this up when you got the angle with Austin on the line, what are you going to do? And I think part of it is Vince's weird mentality to put these guys in spots like that. I wouldn't be surprised if somebody put Austin up to it, to be quite honest. Moving along, though, another one...
Yeah,
maybe...
Scott Orr!
Yeah.
Leave a beer for me, kid.
CS from Pro Wrestling Only also said, Shawn Michaels versus God. He's actually Shawn and God versus Vince and Shane. I actually read Shawn Michaels' book recently, his second one, the one where he talks about religion a lot, and he knew that it was crap, but I don't think that he saw it as like massively offensive himself. So, I don't know, I'm kind of in the same mind, I just thought this was stupid.
Sean is God, so it made no sense to me.
It's hard for me to gauge how offensive this is in the sense that I'm not religious. So to me, I just looked at it as crappy television, really.
Yeah. What about Vince trying to start his own religion? Remember that? In the church?
I always looked at that and thought more about, you know, episode of The Simpsons where Mr. Burns tries to get in on the Movementarians type cult and set up his own one. And they go through the Special K logo and all that stuff. That's just what I thought of when Vince was doing that.
And if Scientology is a religion, why can't McMahonism be one as well?
Plus, I think in terms of like certain angles that Vince McMahon has wanted to do, I can certainly think of at least one that's considerably worse that hopefully we might get to a bit later.
I'm sure there's more than one.
Oh, yeah, no, but there's one I'm thinking of in particular that's scummiest.
The Raven crucifix angle. At least the Undertaker angle really did use a ridiculous Undertaker symbol, so even though the intent was obviously the same, it's too cartoonish to be taken seriously. This is one that Raven had to go out and apologise for, Scummiest? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know what I found.
Bad taste, I guess, some people are prone to be offended. But
what was your opinion on the fact that Raven had to come out and apologise?
That's bullshit.
Yeah.
because I thought it was a cool visual, but again, I'm not religious, so. Yeah. You know, obviously, a lot of people are, especially in America. So, and maybe coming from the bunch of Jews doing it as well.
Yeah. Well, that was Taz's line, wasn't it? And Raven's great line about how if you didn't own a Jewish star, you could have rolled them down the street, which is hilarious.
Well, the whole point, like Raven, anyways, is kind of like a cultist kind of like person.
He does the crucifix pose anyway.
He was doing it to fucking goad you assholes, and it fucking worked because you fucking got offended. That was the
point
of the angle.
This is the problem. I really wish I could speak to somebody who's actually in the building that night to see what the general vibe was, because everybody that says it didn't go down well seems to be
in ECW arena.
Yeah.
I'm not going to turn around and say like people. It was definitely for certain everyone was offended, but if you at least you kind of watch the footage, they were quiet.
I always thought that the crucifix was kind of crude, but I thought that the barbed wire crown of thorns was an awesome little that's a cool large, you know,
since
actual creative
anyway.
Thought, yeah, you know, that's cool.
Thorny crown. CS also says, any miscarriage or spousal abuse angle, Terry Runnels miscarrying and Chaz giving his girlfriend a black eye immediately come to mind in the Attitude Era.
Yeah, agreed. No time for it, and just think.
Why is this? Why is
television?
One of Kieran's lines in the last podcast. Why is this on a wrestling show?
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, ditto.
The miscarriage one is one I've talked about on previous podcasts before, and you know, I just go to the argument of where's the payoff? It's, you know, it's offensive to people, and there's no payoff to it. So why do it?
Fucking point.
Yeah, it's scummy, but it's just stupid. All of the Vicky Guerrero fat shaming comments, especially by who is quickly becoming the patron saint of this topic, Jerry Lawler, King Scumbag, as he calls him here.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I remember like specifically, obviously, them doing it with Vicky Guerrero, but I think it's with anyone. I've noticed they've started doing like a few sly digs towards Kevin Owens now on commentary every now and again about his weight. I don't get in the whole argument about them doing that. You know, their campaign, like, is it Be a Star campaign? Yeah, they do everything they can to objectify. In their history, and even now, they do everything they can to objectify people who are different. It's like, I'm going slightly off topic, but it's in the same kind of way. We'd like to say, like, the Goldust character. Why, you know, the Goldust character was great, and Dustin Rhodes played it so well. But if you just take it out of the context of wrestling, you have a character who's been booed because he's gay. He's not a heel. They're not booing him, and then it turns out, oh, well, they're booing him, and it just so happens he's gay. The American audience are booing him because he's gay. And it's like just things like that when they objectify certain kind of like groups or whatever, like fat being one of them.
I will say, in defense of the Goldust booing, he wasn't a gay, he was a shady gay.
Can I just clarify something? That thing's an anti-bullying campaign.
Yeah.
I thought Scott Hall was the beer star.
That's why he's backwards. Speaking of objectifying, let's get to this one now. He's got a few votes. Mercenary from TPWW Forum says, serious response, is Vince making Trish strip and bark like a dog? Ian Drew Dice Clay in the UK fan forum says, as far as scummy things, Trish barking like a dog is such a vomit-inducing ego trip. I haven't watched it since I saw it on some DVD they put out. What the fuck were they thinking with that one? Martin Bushby on the Facebook page, facebook.com/scgradio, says, Trish Stratus on all fours barking like a dog. When a Rupert Murdoch-owned company is having to cut your stuff in their programming, you really have scraped the barrel in terms of what's acceptable. I mean, come on, this is the same Rupert Murdoch who inflicted Kelvin McKenzie and Piers Morgan on the world. And the brain follower from Pro Wrestling Only says, that Trish moment made me turn my TV off in disgust, but also made me admire her for having the courage to do something like that, work through it, and do what she did for the next 5 years, I guess. If I had been her, I would have said no way to doing that and taken my chances in court. I feel the biggest problem was the payoff. One slap is all she got as payback. She and Stephanie fought on Raw the next night, but the match ended with Regal interfering because, heaven forbid, the almighty Steph do a job. Then the feud was dropped and never mentioned again. Meltzer reported the reason being the dog segment got so much heat that they had to drop the story altogether. 6 weeks later, it just was just the time Stephanie was going to do the job, they had to drop the angle.
I'm going to put one foot on the soapbox for this, because one of the funny things about, like, just with obviously the modern what they're trying to do now with trying to make something of their female talent and so on, and trying to put them over. Anytime now I watch that Attitude Era in particular, same thing with everything else, if you take the wrestling goggles off or nostalgia or something like that, and you just see it and you just watch the show as someone who doesn't know anything about wrestling, the whole treatment during the Attitude Era is pretty fucking embarrassing.
I want to actually give
it's
a shout
really
out.
Bad.
It is. I want to give a shout out to Harmonic Generator on the UK fan forum, who wrote about 2,000 words in response to this question of wrestling's scummiest moments. And one of the things that he went off on was the misogyny during that period of time when, yeah, you know, the women being beaten up gets a pop. It's the, yeah, yeah, all that kind of stuff.
The Dudleys ran, strangely, a very successful angle of putting women through tables and so on. So, like, popularising the idea of beating women up or whatever. And just the
real get your tits out for the lads,
yeah,
era,
yeah,
of wrestling.
Objectification of the women and so on, because at least now they're trying to make them come across as athletes. They're having wrestling matches. In the Attitude Era, You can't even call them matches what they had. It was, everything was pretty much lingerie matches or whatever, or mud bath, freaking, you know, the Miss Rumble freaking bikini contest and stuff like that. And it's like, yeah, yeah, mushy peas in a paper bag. It's just when you actually watch it back, and it's something that never necessarily occurred to me when I was watching at the time, probably because I was 16. Man, how did they get away with some of that? Because, like, really, the objectification of women, like, I don't know how popular media didn't, like, kind of pick up on that. Are you watching this fucking wrestling shit on the other channel and how, like,
well,
people
they
are being
did
portrayed
eventually.
On, did they?
Okay. They did eventually, because that's what got the PTC's panties in a twist,
yeah,
among many other things. But, I mean, to be honest, not defending it, but there was a market for it in society in some twisted way. I mean, there's a reason why they cheered the Dudleys, they got over for doing what they did, and it's not like Sable didn't draw a shitload of money by doing what she was doing. So, unfortunately, Vince is just picking up his doggy scent, and he's following around.
I mean, as sort of distasteful as it can be, let's face facts, the Dudleys weren't over before they started putting women through tables.
Not one bit.
It's what got them over. We talk about 97, 98 Raw. Look at the reactions that, say, Sunny gets when she's no longer just, you know, Sunny of the Body Donners, but he's coming out in really skimpy outfits and, you know, the audible cheers. So the market was there, right, wrong or otherwise. It's one of those things that doesn't hold up well to look back on as a general trend. But specifically with regards to the Trish incident, I almost want to say there was at least a payoff of sorts. It really wasn't in, you know, as the emailer said, the one slap probably wasn't enough in truth. I'm not sure courage is the word I'd use for her going along with it. I would have thought that courage would have been more a case of her refusing to do it. Mm. But, you know, Trish had been in the business, what, just over 12 months at that
Something
point?
Like that.
You know, really, a bit like, say, the Charlotte Reed in sort of situation. Are you going to say no? It's a tough one.
I guess then, like, play fancy booker for a second. What would the payoff have been? Trish making Vince bark like a dog?
Probably,
like,
yeah.
Know, like,
actually,
is that more of a sort of,
yeah,
like, you know...
Well, you know what Vince's logic is for this? his argument would be that ultimately the payoff is Linda rises from the, you know, almost from the dead from the chair, and Shane kicks his ass. So in his mind, that's how he justified it.
Yeah,
I liked it. Thought it was hot.
There was that great Paul Heyman line as well.
I'm going to get to see Bush.
Oh, yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I'll get to see Bush. Yeah.
Moving along, Grecian on the UK fan forum says, CM Punk and The Undertaker for me. That was really uncomfortable to watch, especially the promo where he opened an urn and poured ashes over the downed Undertaker. I know it came out afterwards that Bearer's family agreed for it to happen, but it made me pretty uneasy watching. And Shishin KOPF on the TPWW forum also says, probably CM Punk dumping Paul Bearer's ashes 2 weeks after he died.
Yeah, I think that's exactly it. I mean, it's, if the family, you know, consented to it, that's all fair enough. I think it's more, it's the time scale, I think, is probably what might be people's problem. As I said, it was 2 weeks after. It wasn't like, God, poor guy ain't settled, you know. It's
the body,
like,
wasn't even cold.
Yeah, that's it. That's the phrase. Yeah, the body isn't even cold yet, man. It's just like, come on, just like, it seemed very opportunistic. It's just like, he died, let's use this.
We've got our angle.
Yeah, we got that, yes. But it's the same as the Melanie Pillman stuff. Hey, he signed a contract. I don't give a fuck if he's dead. We're still going to use him.
Yeah.
Hey, if we didn't have that, we wouldn't have got that classic Ern Anderson photo. Do you remember that, Ern Anderson? That was quality.
Yeah, as we said last time, never let a good crisis go to waste.
Yeah.
We mentioned sort of a time frame there in terms of the fact that it's 2 weeks after, so things are still quite raw, which is why it does seem offensive to a lot of people. I think one of the reasons it seems so stark as well is the fact that, but the time in which they do it, you know, we just talked about the Attitude Era and the way women were treated, and there was an audience for it. It just seemed part of the norm. Whereas with the build to Mania with Punk and Bearer's death and all that sort of thing, it was in stark contrast to the rest of the things that they were presenting on TV at the time. It was, you know, it was TV PG. It's more family friendly. And then you have this in sort of, you know, front and centre. So it's sort of, I suppose in that sense, it seems a lot starker in people's minds, possibly. I wasn't particularly comfortable with it, again, because of how soon afterwards it was. But a bit like how we said in part one, it's hard for me to bemoan it too much if the family have really approved it. A bit like the Lawler stuff that we referenced on the previous one. It's difficult for me to preach if the family are okay with it, let's say.
Yeah, I think it's that whole thing with the Punk and Take stuff is a really interesting one for me, because I'd been on a wrestling wilderness for years at that time and hadn't watched for a long time. It may even have been around the first time I started to get to know you, Liam, and chatting again about old shows. I decided that year, from the Rumble onwards, the whole noise that Punk had been making, Rock coming back, and I was like, yeah, I'm gonna watch this. And I remember just getting to Mania and seeing Punk doing that stuff and thinking, God, you know, just a couple of months ago, Swerve's doing the Your Arms Are Too Short to Box with God promo. You know, really good promo. And I was fucking, now he's fucking around pouring ashes all over people. It just, and then you got to Mania, and the two of them had this really good, intense match. I stand by that. Yeah. I just think it's good. And none of the build meant fuck all. It didn't matter, because the match was just these two dudes going for the best match of the night. And that's where it stood. I always think they overbook Taker's Mania angles. I don't think it really needs anything other than, I'm coming for the streak. Okay, you're having it. Well, obviously not now, but, you know, then. Yeah. That's all it needed, not Ern Anderson pouring ashes on. I think the problem with the whole thing with the Pringle angle, once they'd pop, they just couldn't stop.
We're going to get to some drug-related ones now. Can't have wrestling without drugs. Mungo Chutney from the UK Fan Forum says, Hawk jumping / being pushed off the Titantron, another exploitation of the guy's real-life drug issues.
That's another bullshit angle, to be honest with you.
Yeah?
Yeah. I mean,
Hawk stumbling off the stage.
Yeah. Yeah, obviously, using a guy's real-life situation, there's definite scum in that.
Yeah.
But, again, it's just so many. Maybe it's because I don't get offended by anything. I just think it's some, you know, bullshit, stupid angles that don't belong on a wrestling show. So, you know, I'm sure if members of the audience had gone through their own drug or alcohol problems, maybe they would have been offended by it.
Alcohol problems, you say? Well, allow me to step in. much like yourself, Kieran, I looked at it more as just terrible TV, and I'd sort of chalk it up to it almost an appropriate way to bookend what had been a horrible year for the Road Warriors in general, the way they'd been treated, more or less since their return in the spring of 97. They'd not been booked particularly well. I thought this would just sort of summed it up, really.
Exile from TPWW Forum says, Jeff Hardy shows up for a world title match so fucked up he can barely walk and they still let him go out there.
Yeah, that's fucking TNA for you.
That one actually annoyed me a great deal
at
the time.
Yeah, I mean, that's just dangerous for everyone involved. When it's so insulting what you're going to do anyway, just don't do the match.
Yeah,
you don't have to. It's fucking TNA anyway. Okay, and I summed up the bad of TNA in so many ways for me.
You know, we talked a few minutes ago about how it's hard to be really offended if the participants themselves are willing and they're, you know, they've all had sort of cognitive thoughts and all that sort of thing.
I see where you're going.
But Jeff Hardy was in no fit state that night to determine what was the best thing to do, what was right. And that really was just almost exploitation, really, and typical just, well, there's not much more you can say than typical TNA. It's just appropriate, isn't it? He's either drunk or drugged up, pilled up. He's on something. But we've advertised this, and 13 people have bought this pay-per-view. Get out there, Jeff.
Good luck. Hope you can get up the stairs.
To be absolutely honest, I wouldn't call this a scummy moment in wrestling. I'll just call it downright fucking moronic. it's just beyond actual belief that any company or whatever, they call themselves a company, would actually do something as unprofessional as this. What Jeff did was unprofessional, turning up in the state. What they did eclipses that in terms of unprofessional, and I don't blame Sting's reaction to it. Oh, I'm actually surprised.
You should have said I wouldn't have done them. I would have said no.
Exactly. But I'm surprised that Sting actually did anything at all. I'm surprised he didn't just walk away and just said, "This is fucking ridiculous. I'm not even going to freaking do the stinger. I'm not even going to do the death drop on him. I'm just not even going to do anything."
Yeah, let's just drop this fucking pilled up guy on the back of his head, shall we?
There is literally 100 different things they could have done than that. 100 different things. As you guys said, he wasn't even the champion going in. They could have come up with another challenger. They certainly had, at that time, enough people who could have been realistic challengers. It's not even necessarily like with the WWE, where everything stops at Vince, where you can just turn around and say, like, "Vince, that was your fucking fault." There was enough people. There were a conveyor belt of people who were apparently in areas of management or in charge or whatever. And on this conveyor belt, as basically like the fucking Generation Game, right? He's the cuddly toy. As he's going on the conveyor belt, or quality check in the toy factory, they put him on the conveyor belt, and as he's going along the conveyor belt, no one's fucking checking him on quality and saying, like, "Hold on a sec, has he got like any needles sticking out of his fucking claw or anything like that? What the fuck's wrong with this teddy bear?" No, they just guide him on through, wrap him up, package him, then give him to the fucking kids. It's like, God, it's bloody ridiculous.
Yeah, to that I'd say, yeah, but this is TNA, and the conveyor belt of incompetence shouldn't surprise anyone. I really do put a lot of blame on Sting for this. He's experienced enough. No one would have said boo to a goose to Sting saying no. He'd been on the wise old head. He should have taken responsibility and said no.
Had Sting actually seen him before they'd gone out, or did like the first time Sting saw the condition he was in when he stepped through? He fell through the freaking curtain.
This ain't Bill Watts Mid South. They weren't in separate dressing rooms. He'd have seen him. The impact zone ain't that big, for Christ's sake.
Well, isn't the deal that they didn't know where he was? He's just at the gorilla position. They found him like sitting on the floor of the bathroom or something like that. And then they just like picked him up and like took him there.
So no one had seen him all day apart from...
He disappeared for quite some time before the match.
I think that, like, for me, this would have been a golden opportunity for one of wrestling's unscummiest moments, where literally we always say, "Oh, you know, they have to bring real life problems." Have someone, I don't even know who the authority figures were at the time.
Bischoff.
I know Bischoff was around, but was he heel or face?
Oh, he's a heel. He's the one that came into the ring and had to tell Stink, so wrap this up in 30 seconds.
Yeah, and what I think that someone should have done is just got on the mic and just literally said, "Jeff is here, but he's absolutely in no state to perform. So rather than put the risk of our talent at risk, we're going to support him through whatever needs to happen next, but instead we're going to have to offer you an alternative main event and just find the best worker on the roster and just put him in the ring with Sting and let him tear it
down." Could have done a surprise on short notice.
You know, whatever, whoever.
But at the same time, it's TNA, so if you'd actually done an honest thing like that, they probably would have thought it was a shitty angle. But at the end of the day, was it the Impact Zone?
Yeah.
So they weren't even paying customers anyway.
Yeah. So they didn't get fucked, really. So it's just the pay-per-view fans, I guess.
The equivalent really would be like me and Liam being at work and like me going around to get him for a meeting and find him slumped in the corner absolutely like piddling on himself and going, "Fuck, I best just prop him up and Weekend at Bernie's him into the meeting and like just try and convince people he was there." It's one of those that, again, not particularly watching that product at the time, you just got sent by someone. It's like, you've got to see it, and you're like, "What the what is happening here? I can't even figure out."
Is that like that fucking silly smile on Jeff's face when the camera zooms in on him?
It's just bad. I might watch it after we get finished.
Oh, totally.
TNA, the new face of professional wrestling.
Moving now from the subject of drugs and wrestling to murder in wrestling. Dave, 1981 from WrestlingForum.com says, Bruiser Brody's murder and cover-up is without question the worst thing to have ever happened in wrestling. For a promoter to cover up a murder backstage at his show, then turn the murderer babyface on the back of it and create a storyline to profit is reprehensible. I've always heard Brody was a prick backstage who'd refuse to lose to anyone and would no-sell wrestlers he either didn't like or didn't think he should sell for. Carl's got a big smile on his face for the same reason I have. But he was brutally stabbed and left to die in a shower room. A while back I read police were on the scene but didn't take it seriously and thought it was part of the show and didn't speak any English, so Brody ended up dying of a loss of blood and literally bleeding to death. I think Tony Atlas did a shoot in which he said American wrestlers due to give evidence against Invader 1 didn't receive their subpoenas until a day or two after the trial had finished, and some were dated 2 weeks before being posted, so the whole thing was covered up on many levels. Taker's Revenge on WrestlingForum.com says it's got to be the Bruiser Brody thing for sure, and then WWC's decision to turn Invader face following it. Karma does bite back, however, as I believe he had a house fire not too long ago. So, I don't know what to say about that, really. Roy on the UK fan forum says, I'd like to offer the whole Bruiser Brody Invader 1 Carlos Colon murder in Puerto Rico and the subsequent angles Colon promoted on the back of it. As though Invader 1 actually murdering Brody by stabbing him to death in a shower wasn't enough, Colon portrayed Invader 1 as a babyface while he was on trial for murder, and even ran an angle where Invader 1 was attacked by another wrestler in a shower, and the show closed with blood trickling down the drain. Naturally, Vince McMahon put Carlos Colon in the WWE Hall of Fame in 2014. PTO on their F4W Online says, hard for me to imagine scummier stuff than profiting off death. Only to doing that angle with Invader 1 turning a real murder into fodder for a wrestling angle, and also because if you believe some people, it was just a front to lure Invader to Japan so he could get whacked by the Yakuza. And Jap Jesus on F4W Online wraps it up by saying Herb Abrams announcing Bruiser Brody was coming to the UWF years after he died.
Even Fritz didn't try that shit.
This whole thing, because I remember reading a little bit more detailed account when you handed me the book Meltzer
tributes.
Wrote tributes, yeah, and reading it and just thinking, this fucking reeks of shit. Was Dutch Mantel there?
Yeah, this is Puerto Rico.
Dutch Mantel there commenting about it and saying like how dodgy it was, and just and basically reinforcing the aspect of the story that he was stabbed in the shower and that everyone continued getting changed, like right next to him, or at least like in the other room, you know, that it wasn't like he was out of eyeshot or anything like that. Like they fucking knew what had happened, what was going on, and they just left him there to die. And it's like, whatever I hear, whatever kind of version of anybody's story or eyewitness accounts they have, it's fucking horrid. I don't give a shit if he was difficult to deal with, if he was an asshole, if he didn't want to do the job, if you were scared of him, if he shit in your fucking PE bag, doesn't warrant murdering someone. This isn't the scummiest moments. Probably the potential cover-up and like the whole trial is scummy, but the actual act itself is just fucking horrific. It doesn't seem to be like a definitive story. There's just eyewitness accounts and some of them vary, so you kind of have to like sieve through some of the bullcrap or the biasness or whatever. Either way, someone was murdered, someone blatantly got away with it, papers were fiddled, post was not sent, whatever, it was beyond scummy. This is like another level.
I read recently Gary Hart's book, and that has, you know, not so much a I was there account of it, but just a lot about Bruiser Brody and about the perceived difficulties and things, because he was very close to Gary Hart. Gary Hart's kids, you know, grew up around him and things like that. And you know, if anyone wants to read a bit more about it, you know, highly recommend. I know it's a very hard book to come across.
I think one of the reasons for there being so many conflicting stories around it, G, to go to your point, is it breaks down along Puerto Rican guys and non-Puerto Rican guys, you know. Those that were tight in with Carlos Colon, regular workers in the company, and those that were sort of visiting workers, if you like. A lot of vested interests that went beyond just Carlos Colon and beyond Invader 1. When you asked us at the end of the first show, Liam, what we thought was the most scummiest, I didn't really think about this one at the time. Obviously, we hadn't talked about it during the show, but now just sort of as a refresh, hearing it all again and...
Yeah, the baby face.
The baby facing element of it is where you get the real scummy promoter side of things.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I mean, yeah, the murder goes without saying, it's horrific. The cover up is deplorable. If there was one, you know, contradicting stories, maybe guys are actually covering their own asses for not going. that's why they, you know, oh, they get the poster the day after, so, you know, it's wrestlers remember. So I would discount that because, you know, as a crime, disgusting crimes, like the Benoit one, you know, it goes about saying, but it's the reaction. Using it as an angle and turning the guy babyface, that's what is scummy. That's fucking, that's like condoning it. It's condoning the action.
Not only that, but profiting from it.
Exactly, profiting, condoning, just... The guy's name's Colon, so what do you expect? But, yeah, I'd still put it behind Melanie Pillman, because that, I mean, that was just exploitative to the max of a living... You know, that was just different kind of disgusting. But it's right up there for me.
Moving along now to a gentleman who was mentioned as the scummiest moment in general his existence. Paul Seaway on the FOW board mentioned Ian Rotten and said he amongst other things, and we'll get to one of the other ones that he's mentioned here for a later one, pocketed the proceeds of tribute shows to dead wrestlers in which talent volunteered to work for free, hosted a benefit show for former deathmatch wrestler Delilah Starr and her sick child only to give her $100 and pocketed the rest for himself, threatened to kill IWA Mid-South several times unless fans gave him more money, selling his video library to High Spots and RF Video on the same day behind each other's back, not telling either company about the deal, nor Smartmark Video, which actually recorded and produced the videos, paying JC Bailey with drugs for his work at King of the Deathmatch when Bailey was trying to clean up at the time, showing up at JC Bailey's funeral uninvited, causing a scene and demanding that Bailey give him gas money, refusing to refund fans money for tickets sold to cancel events, and stealing a Riviera Steakhouse jacket. Who does that? And before I, everybody's kind of diving in here on Ian Rotten, so there's one more. R.D. Reynolds of WrestleCrap fame on the FOW message board says, wasn't a promoting issue, but I was once at a really busy restaurant in Indy with Ian Rotten. He started screaming at the poor waitress, yelling at her, and I quote, "Don't you know who I am?" Yes, Ian Rotten thought he was so famous everyone should know who he was. Rarely have I ever been so embarrassed, and I felt so horrible for that girl.
Piece of shit. That's all I'm going to say.
I mean, what we've just gone through there, we've certainly gone through some scummy moments there, but I think we've definitely found the scummiest fucking person.
Well, there's another one later on.
Can
so
I
that's
just
not...
check, did you say he turned up at a funeral and demanded the dead guy give him the money for gas?
It looks that way, doesn't it?
Yeah, like you open casket and just gets in and takes his wallet. Jesus. Yeah, definitely scummiest guy alive.
It's almost like the Fritz Von Erich playbook just taken to another level, isn't it? I mean, you know, Ian Rotten is just, you know, a human piece of garbage. He's an absolute waste of skin and oxygen, and he's really... I was
he should be skinned alive!
I always thought of him as just a deplorable person for his matches with Axel Rotten, and the fact that he ran at IWA Mid-South without all the tidbits and the rap sheet that Liam just read to us, so... In the same way that TNA is TNA, Ian Rotten is just Ian Rotten.
Vince has obviously certainly had plenty in his time, but obviously would over a long career in charge. This guy has got to be level pegging with Vince in terms of the scummiest character. I mean, the fact that, just like any good story, the further you read, the worse it gets. Yeah. It's just like, this guy never learned about anything. He never learned decorum. He can't even fucking spell it, I'm sure.
Well, just as a quick one around the table there then, G, since you sort of broached the subject. As bad as Vince McMahon, to me, I'd argue he's almost possibly worse than Vince.
Yeah.
It's a different kettle of fish, surely.
Vince, we could say he's exploitative with a sense of naivety almost. This is just low rent, desperation, money grabbing,
carny,
evil piece of shit.
CSL on TPWW Forum says, maybe that promoter who bought a completely height of his problem Scott Hall out for that one indie show despite the fact he probably should have been in hospital, let alone in front of an audience. The Lone Star on WrestlingForum.com says that idiot bingo hall owner / promoter that let a pill-stricken and drunk Scott Hall come out a day after overdosing. Happened in 2010 and was awful. ESPN E60 showed
this. Yeah, it was a documentary where they were showing like the Scott Hall and they were just like... They would, like, carrying him out like he was an old man. Well, I mean, he's getting on a bit, but, like, they were walking him out like he was 90 years old. They were, like, guiding him up the steps and stuff, and it was just, like, heartbreaking to see this guy be like that. But also just the fact, it's just, like, oh, it's just that mentality. It's almost like the rotten mentality of just, like, well, I paid for you, so it doesn't matter what condition you're in, I'm going to wheel you out, even if it's in a fucking wheelbarrow.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a mix of Jeff Hardy and TNA with a bit of... Ian Rotten thrown in as well.
Yeah.
Lee123 from the FOW board says that Vince or the WWF had any role in obstructing justice in the likely murder by Jimmy Snuka of Nancy Argentino. That should make the list. One of your favourites, Carl, I'm sure.
It's alleged.
I've said for years the man was guilty. Irv Mushnick was right. Obviously, something underhand went on during the proceedings. I'm not saying necessarily. I'm not saying Vince necessarily rocked up with this briefcase full of money, as has been suggested at times. At best, it's just ineptitude from local law enforcement. At worst, someone's carried some favours because they run, you know, TV tapings what, three times a month there, something like that. At the time when they were doing their weekly TV out of Pennsylvania. There's not much you can point your finger to and say Vince definitely did this. I mean,
there is the scene of him walking into the room with the briefcase and walking out, and the problems went away, as Snuka said.
As Snuka said.
Yeah,
and this.
I'm sure he has full recall of everything.
Exactly. It's just, well, because we've all heard, you know, he played the savage in the room while Vince spoke, and we weren't in that room. We can't possibly know, but. It's hard for me to say it's scummy because of a lack of real hard facts around it, but there is something sort of troubling, if you like, unsettling about it.
Speaking of more real-life questionable incidents and individuals, King Pitcast on the UK fan forum says, employing/enabling the likes of Grizzly Smith for years is scummier than any tasteless wrestling storyline. We're all complicit in the scumminess as well, as there's probably nobody on the planet more U-tree than Jerry Lawler, and every one of us would give him a big cheer at a show.
Jake Roberts was born out of love and he still loves him.
Oh, come on, Carl. Let's not have any of that. Oh. By the way, if nobody knows this, by the way, it's the allusion to Grizzly Smith being a paedophile, let's be quite honest. Including his own daughter, it came out recently in an interview.
The story goes, and again, the only person I've heard recall this story is Jake, so, you know, take it how you want. Grizzly Smith was dating Jake's mother's mother at the time. Had sex with the daughter when she was how old? Was it 13? Yeah, so that's
That's what was said on the Beyond the Mat.
It was on the Beyond the Mat documentary. To the emails, but it's the way it's been enabled, and
people talk about how great a guy
he
is. Yeah,
well,
that's
all you hear, because people Bill Watts has referenced him enough times, and a lot of sort of the older wrestlers. A lot of people will sort of equate him to Ernie Ladimer. So they sort of use them in the same stories, treat them in the same vein of almost this veteran who would take care of the guys. And I think even Cornette has stories about how Grizzly protected him. And also, all the while, you sort of sit there when you hear this and think, yeah, okay, fine. But he had sex with a 13-year-old girl.
How can your stomach not turn being around this man? Yeah.
How could you want to be anywhere near the man?
Maybe he's a really nice guy. He just wouldn't hire him as a babysitter. In case he pulled the old Lawler special.
Hey, at least Lawler took him to school afterwards.
Moving from one horrible subject to another here, Pantsless Yoda on FOW says, another one, although it might have been worse, was Harley Race calling Ron Simmons the N-word in WCW. That's just low and unimaginative. Maybe the reason that so many minority wrestlers have struggled to draw or do well in the major promotions is they keep on getting sucked into corny racism-tinged stories that make anyone with two brain cells that can rub together turn the channel.
Well,
it wasn't the N-word, was it? It was boy or something like that that he actually said, and they bleeped it out to make you think that he'd said the N-word. Not that it's okay to again, but it's trying to...
Harley's fault then, he didn't do anything wrong.
WCW had a tendency, they did it with JYD as well, where... I don't want to accuse like a certain mentality or something like that with it being a Southern company, but that was almost that kind of outdated, more than anything else, idea from what worked in the 60s and 70s when you got bookers like Ole in there thinking, well, this will draw. And there's another one here. Joe G from Pro Wrestling Only says, Bill Watts saying a black man is only good for shining shoes and carrying a white man's bags. Racism gets heat, I get it, but it was in the spring and summer after MLK had been shot and he was wrestling Bobo Brazil in Washington, D.C. The city had just been burned to the ground in the riots. Seriously, whole neighborhoods in D.C. didn't recover for 30-some years from the civil unrest of that spring, and Bill Watts was cutting a racist promo 6 weeks later to promote his feud with Bobo Brazil.
Never saw him with the hood on, brother.
I was actually going to explain what that line is, since you've dropped it about three times on previous podcasts. It's a line from a Ron Simmons shoot interview when he's asked if he thought Bill Watts was a racist, and Ron Simmons' freak was, I never saw him with a hood on.
Tasteless, it's sort of, you know, the low-rent side of wrestling, that obviously the time frame is... makes a big difference as well. it's hard to put in the modern context, not because I want to defend what he said by any means, it's deplorable, but it's just their mentality then was just so different, and you know that they assumed on the basis of the heel getting heat it was fair game, and in the end it would be okay because you know the babyface would eventually get the one over on the heel. So it's just I'm struggling to describe this in an appropriate way, I think, but it's just the way their mentality was. They obviously didn't see anything wrong with it because they thought, you know, I'm going to get my ass kicked in the end, so it's all okay. But obviously we, not being in the wrestling bubble and sort of, you know, from the outside looking in, we think, gosh, why would you do that? And not just at that time, I suppose, that time being significant, but at any point, why would you think that's acceptable?
I mean, if you did that today, obviously, the fucking world would come crashing down on you if you're the guy who said that. But I think it's kind of maybe an indication of the mentality of the times anyway. That's not to excuse it, it's almost to compound the issue. But I would assume it wasn't perceived as big a deal as looking back. It's all, I don't know, it's two ways of looking at it. One, it probably wasn't perceived as badly at the time, although as we would perceive it now. But the same way, it's also more inciting at the time because of the real issues.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I've explained that very well.
Raw emotion out.
It's raw, it's real, but the white mentality at the time is still. It's still. I think it would almost go under the table, and just because of the weakened black voice at the time, I would say. I might be way off on this. If I am, then let me know, folks. Imagine if you did that, went to Ferguson and did that today. Yeah, it's just bad. It's just tasteless. It's
scummiest up there.
I think it'd be right up there for me.
Otto Den Vons on the UK fan forum says, adding to the growing tally of racism shouts, Kamala was portrayed as the Ugandan savage from a jungle who needed a handler to be controlled and was implied to be into cannibalism. After that dreadful casket match with The Undertaker, he was given a new manager to try and humanise him in what can only be described as an example of wrestling's backward logic as it turned him babyface.
I wouldn't say offensive. Obviously not a black, so maybe would, but to me it was just more shit. A shit gimmick that's just ridiculous and stupid, and you wouldn't want any of your non-wrestling friends in the room when he came on the TV. Fine line between, I suppose there's not because how it's presented, but Kamala and Umaga.
It's really kind of riding the line, maybe on the slightly other path to it, something like along the lines of Crime Time as well was a little bit too on the nose. I mean, they'll just turn around and say, nah, it's just a couple of hood guys, just turns out they're black. It's like, yeah, but there's a connotation there. It's like you got a black tag team, they've got to be criminals. It's just there's something about it where it's kind of like that's a little on the nose.
They were so fucking scared that people were going to see it that way too, because, and the thing is, it's like if you had like a couple of badass black guys who kind of got a gangster characterization or whatever, it probably wouldn't really bat that many eyelids, I shouldn't imagine, because whatever. But it's the WWE's having to market with something, you know, let's stamp this with something, I don't know, Crime Time. And then, so they want to market it that way, but they also were so afraid that it was going to be seen for what you're suggesting, G, that they did that stupid press release on WWE.com, if you remember that, saying that how this is a, what you're going to see is a bunch of stunts parodying Saturday Night Live stereotypes or something like that. And it's like, it's just such bullshit. Like, you want to have your cake and eat it in every single way.
It's quite interesting when talking about like kind of racism or whatever, or kind of like racist characteristics for black athletes in the company and so on. And then when you look, like, I guess you could probably say on the other side of things, when you're looking at like the Nation of Domination and stuff, where they kind of like revert it or something like that, where it's kind of like now a black group who are kind of like being pro-black and against everything else, I guess. But like I thought it was quite interesting. I wasn't offended by that angle at all. I thought it was a very interesting one. So I just find it quite interesting how, like, when it's one way it's bad, when the other way it's like, at least for me, I guess I'm probably not painting myself a very pretty picture, but like it comes across as a bit more interesting.
Just to cover Kamala quickly, I probably, because of my age at the time of watching it as well, it's not something that really struck a chord with me. It didn't cut to the bone or anything like that in that sense. It was, in terms of things like Crime Time and the Nation, Crime Time was very much the way that the company telegraphed it, as Liam said, it was sort of the have your cake and eat it. The Nation, I find, again, at the time of watching it, a lot of things I didn't really grasp or didn't fully appreciate. Watching it back more recently, as part of the prep for the timeline shows that we do, I find the Nation stuff much more blunt, if you like, and much more on the nose. It really is sort of sailing close to the wind, you know, with the sort of the language it's used.
Threatening to kick Ahmed Johnson's black ass and stuff like that.
Words like cracker,
Uncle Tom.
If I'm not mistaken, I think honky is used on more than one occasion by Farouk to describe Ahmed Johnson as well. Because obviously the Nation is a playoff.
Can you imagine Vince trying to tell these guys to do this?
Yeah, like, yeah. It's just. But the Nation's obviously it's a playoff of the Nation of Islam and Malcolm X, so it's got those sort of very much real world ties that something like Crime Time maybe does to a point, but it is quite sort of caricatured as is Kamala. So, to me the Nation is much. You're watching, ooh, jeez, they really did cut close with some of the stuff they're coming out with here. I'm surprised they got away with it.
I'm a little bit more kind of intrigued by that, like as an angle, like how they developed it. Whilst everything else is way too caricature and comedic and just roll of the eyes, like, okay, that's just ridiculous. It came across so much more kind of realistic and honing in on something that's actually palpable in society at that time or in the past, whatever. So I was a lot more intrigued by that. As I don't think it was the right way to book anything. I think anything to do with race, as I mentioned earlier, anything that highlights race or individuality or something like that, or a group of people, I think is wrong. I don't think they should be doing that. But I just always thought that Nation angle was just, I don't know, always struck intriguing me. Maybe it's a fascination how they got away with it. Maybe that's why I find the angle interesting. So it's just like, how did they get away with that?
It's just, I think any time you stray into the discussion of stereotypes, archetypes of anything like this, it all becomes about perception and how it's presented. Like, none of us are sitting here going, and I'm really not sure about those sort of white sort of portrayals of the white characters in DOA and these skinheads, and it's very, very sort of a damning portrayal of white people. I'm not sitting here going, I really want to sort of put one out there for my upper middle class friends with ponytails. The Hunter Hearst Helmsley character was a very offensive character to that group. This is the problem, is we're, you almost have to say, do we just rid any kind of character archetypes, and literally Paul Burchill is just a wrestler who happens to be like a pirate, because he can't show any pirate type behaviour, because that's going to be offensive to him as a serious pirate out there. I don't know where it ends without stripping everything and just having dudes in trunks, and you say, right, you go out, what do you do?
Yeah, well, I'm fully the opposite end of the scale to you, Chase, along with you. This is fucking driven by white guilt or something. Mm. And you know what? It's not offensive to have the Nation doing a Nation of Islam knockoff, and they're all black, because why the fuck would you have a white guy in there?
Crush.
Yeah, exactly. It made no sense. Yeah, you said the biker thing's a perfect example, and the Latinos with the lowriders.
Yeah.
But a lot of, it's the context. It's not portraying that every black guy is in the Nation or every black guy is a criminal. But you know what? So are we supposed to say The Wire, the greatest TV show of all time, was racist because it portrayed black people as drug dealers or abusers? No, because in certain sections of society, that's true. It's context, and the subtlety to not portray every black guy as a stereotype. Just because that is a gimmick in its own right isn't offensive to me. I think it's white guilt. People jump on it and think you're more scared of what other people might think about it than thinking about it logically. Unlike the Booker T stuff we talked about before, Triple H.
Yeah.
That is the other scale. That for me is, that's bullshit. But people jump in on the bandwagon just because it's fear of what someone else might say, but just my personal take on this political correctness, man, pisses me off.
Undefeated stake on the UK fan forum says, of all the shit that went down in ECW, New Jack cutting that young lad up always stood out to me as a shite move. Afro Latino on WrestlingForum.com says, I vote for Mass Transit 2, something that should have not happened in any promotion. Rydum N Style on the UK fan forum says, has the Mass Transit incident in ECW been mentioned yet? That's my nod for this. Completely rotten to the core, that whole deal from the guy blagging his in-ring credentials to New Jack going way, way over the line. And Gordy M on the UK fan forum says, New Jack, you could dedicate a podcast to all the shitty things he's done. There is, of course, the Mass Transit incident where New Jack, as he stated himself in interviews, took offence to the kid talking to him pre-match about some spots he wanted to do. That's it. He's sliced and bloodied that poor kid with the gusto of a hungry blind man trying to eat a raw steak, all because he decided the kid's over-eagerness was disrespectful and he needed to be put in his place. Then there's the Gypsy Joe match. New Jack thought the old guy wasn't selling enough and started beating the shit out of him for real. Maybe Gypsy Joe wasn't selling hard enough, maybe he was simply old as fuck and should have been applauded for being able to stand up for so long and do anything, never mind wrestle. But no, fucking New Jack wasn't prepared to give the old geezer even a tiny bit of leeway. Imagine if Willy Wonka had started wailing on Grandpa Joe after discovering he took a sip of fizzy lifting drink and stopped him to a bloody puddle while screaming, "Fuck you, cracker." This disturbing match is the wrestling equivalent, except without Oompa Loompas unless Taz was in the audience. However, New Jack's worst and scummiest moment by far has to be his match with William Lane. According to New Jack, Lane was hitting him for real, either because he didn't know or didn't care that wrestling's supposed to be a work. New Jack's response? To pull out a hidden knife and stab Lane approximately a dozen times. It seemed Lane made the mistake of bringing fists to a knife fight. When he rolled out of the ring and onto the floor to, you know, try and not die, New Jack followed him out, stamped on his head, and kept Lane pinned to the ground underneath his boot. When another wrestler tried to run out to try and save Lane, New Jack tried to stab that guy too. New Jack takes things far beyond scummy. He's a piece of shit. I love to see him go up against a genuine tough guy like Lesnar without his weapons, and watch how quickly that cowardly scumbag toes the line and does exactly what he's supposed to do. Christ, I hate that guy.
Player 2 has entered the game. Okay, we found a new king of the hill. I think I never think about New Jack because I actively try and do everything I can to forget his fucking existence. Like, okay, Rotten's fucking horrible, and if you guys want to rate him as the scummiest, definitely. But for me, this guy just pins it as just all-round piece of shit who I can't fucking stand. And the more I hear about, and like when you just do like monologues like that about the sort of things you would do, it just reignites the hate that I have for this guy. I mean, just as you're saying with the thing with stabbing, bring it. What fucking business does a wrestler have bringing a concealed fucking knife into a match? It's like, the guy should have been fucking strung up just for that. Like how did he get booked again? Like, he brought a fucking knife into a match. How is he still working after that? That's absolutely astounding. It just shows, like, either this guy's just insane or just fucking retarded. I don't know. It's something, because the fact that, you know, trying to stab this kid, when the kid kind of rolls out, you know, which is basically probably international sign for stop, right? He continues to do it, and then when someone actually comes out of the LB, he starts fucking turning on him. Like, honestly, if you actually got like any sort of like sanity to you, right, and you believe you have a decent reason for stabbing this kid, then you wouldn't stab a fucking random guy who's trying to help him. You just fucking stop. Every time I like see any interview with him, I just want to punch him in the face.
No, stab you, don't do that.
Yeah, yeah. And so, when he says about Lesnar, yeah, I would like to see that, because Lesnar would fucking beat the shit out of him. What I'd rather like to see him do is put into a room with a bunch of fucking people who he's upset or beat up or stabbed or whatever, with him without a fucking weapon, and then see him fucking like try and be a badass then.
He'll never be Denzel, but he might be Denzel's best friend.
You know what I would pay to see, though? New Jack versus Invader 1 in a knife fight. Fucking sweet. Yeah, coming off the last one, I like this one. It's, you know, New Jack perpetuating black stereotypes worldwide. So, yeah.
Scummy's not the right word here, but I suppose what people probably find so bloody infuriating about New Jack is it's terrible in the first instance that you do these things. It's another thing to be on camera several hundred times over the years, then bragging about these things. And the line he likes to trot out is, he's like OJ. I'm like OJ, did it and got away with it. That's, and there's no sense of remorse or anything, I think, which is what sort of, you know, is really, you know, it's just sort of rubs salt into the wounds almost. It really grates on you. And a bit like some others that we've alluded to, New Jack's got his enablers, which is infuriating. And you watch that Forever Hardcore documentary. There's several on that are all, I think Kid Cash is one. I'm sort of blasé about it. They mock the fact of this 17-year-old kid who's, you know, bleeding a gusher, being led out by his parents, or I think it's his father, and they sort of have a bit of a laugh and a joke in the locker room about it because he says, "I'm one of the boys." And I'm just completely taking advantage of this kid. Has this kid lied about his documentation? Absolutely. But, you know, his biggest crime is being naive. He's asked to, you know, do a blade job, so New Jack obviously just slices and dices one of those damn pizza cutters he brings to the ring.
Yeah, it's a surgical scalpel, wasn't it? Even better.
Yes, it was. Sorry, you're right. It's infuriating that he did it. It's also incredibly infuriating that he brags about it and he still gets employed to this day.
JM Fabiano RPL posted this on the UK Fan Forum and on Pro Wrestling Only, so I'll give you some props for your gusto there. Did anyone say Kurt Angle telling Jeff Jarrett that he wasn't the only one to lose a wife in TNA? This is after obviously Jeff's wife died of cancer years before. No one did say that, and that's, I actually didn't know that had happened because I was not following TNA.
I vaguely remember it.
Yeah. It did lead to that great street fight they had.
I honestly have no memory of that at all. No.
So who said that? Who said that to who?
Angle said it to Jarrett. This is after Jarrett.
Karen left.
Because Karen.
Yeah, I know. I was just going to say who said it to who.
Yeah. Not the best taste line there from Kurt. Also, he says, "R.I.P. Roddy Piper, you were great, but the whole TNA Russo Owen Hart speech, that was one of my least favourites. If anybody around the table remembers that fucking." Awful angle when Piper was trying to shoot in the ring. This is when Russo was during the SEX period, for those of you who don't know, and Piper starts the show off basically plugging his book. This whole thing is one big effort to plug his book, and talks about Russo being a writer and did you write my friend Owen Hart's death, and it just goes silent and it's awful, and then he starts talking about he's my cousin and he's dead and stuff like that, and then Russo comes out, it turns into a big pile of shit. As with anything that is a pile of shit, the Harris boys show up.
Because it's not a genuine piece of, or no. pile of shit until the Harris boys arrive.
Exactly. It is awful. And again, what's worse is that Roddy Piper tried to justify this on various radio shows I've heard, saying, well, wouldn't you do something if your colleague had died in an accident? It's like, it's not real.
Yeah.
Owen Hart being dead is, of course, but you know what I'm saying.
And certainly you wouldn't choose... or just so happened to choose the start of the TV show in the public forum to air grievances such as that.
It's the idea of it coming from Piper and Russo, who are thinking this would be good to do to make people think it's a shoot, is where it comes from. It's like, that's just two completely misguided people doing something that nobody wants. And it was in bad taste.
Yeah, well, it's... in his sort of typical Russo stuff, he'd gone through... I think several of these during the course of the SEX days, I think he'd had people like Shivani do the quote-unquote shoot remarks in the ring, but obviously this one's a completely different kettle of fish. We talked before about how, like, using Kamala as an example, yeah, you'd be uncomfortable or embarrassed to have friends see it when you're watching it. The Piper Russo one is one where I generally just felt uncomfortable watching it by myself. Felt quite embarrassed to watch it myself. I think, God, they... Because it almost makes you think, they have a real low opinion of us, don't they?
Yeah.
If they think this is what we're going to get our jollies off and going to sink our teeth into and really enjoy, then you really do think we're just, you know, a couple of steps up from dragging our knuckles or being part of the Carney Brigade.
We're plankton, basically, is what you think. Also, he says, to the indies, we know there are companies who trot out easy-to-fake masks and former WWE superstars like Doink and the Patriot. You may vary on how offensive that is, but one company also had a fake Golga and kept promoting him as the original WWE oddity years after John Tenta died. This in general, these Bush League promoters, you know, I remember going to one in Oaken Gates here, and this is something that we'll all smile about around the table, about them saying that on the next show the original Undertaker was going to be there, and also on the next show is the tribute version of Scotty Too Hotty! And it's like stuff like that, that's Bush League. It's so Bush. I can't say scummiest, but it is low rent, nickel and diamond.
Just a quick question. How shit must you be to be the tribute act for Scotty Too Hotty? You know, because let's face it, Scotty Too High, he was pretty shit. So just how fucking god-awful are you if you're not even good enough to be perceived on a par with Scotty Too High? You're a notch below.
How bad does the company have to be that they use a tribute Scotty Too High as like a headline act, like a main selling point?
It's you
like,
just know that
it wouldn't work if you had the real Scotty Too High.
Every time fake Scotty Too High comes in, he looks up at the board hoping his name's opposite fake Dean Malenko. He's like, come on, welcome match, welcome match.
Norcross RD on the FOW board says, general scum is advertising wrestlers you know aren't showing up. And Hank on the FOW board says, false advertising wrestlers when they know they aren't going to appear. Blatantly ripping off your customers is something that always particularly irked me. It's premeditated, so it's worse to me than some other scum decisions that were made on the fly in the heat of the moment. Rick Rude was quite aghast at this, wasn't he, when he got he was on the outs with the company at the time, and they continued to advertise his name on the cards even though they knew he wasn't going to be there. So, and when he asked for a share of the money that it drew, they told him to basically fuck off. So Rude said, okay.
Well, actually, because no, you've just jogged my memory on that, just so I'm thinking along the right lines here. It's not as if they even just advertised him for a few house shows, did they? He was originally advertised for the Survivor Series that year, if I'm not mistaken.
Was the Austin one as well?
Oh, Survivor Series. Yeah. Survivor Series 1999, where it's supposed to be Austin, Rock, and Triple H in the triple threat, and they knew he wasn't going to be there.
Yeah,
that's a dirty one.
Yeah, I think it's like another take on this one, and having been someone who, for my sins, lived through a few years as a big 1PW fan, it's the very sort of like Wild West nature of indie promotions, in that, like, I think there are often times when, you know, promoters absolutely believe that wrestlers are going to be there right up until the time of the show, and then you get the out comes the promoter and says, and this guy was supposed to be on a flight and now he's not here, and, you know, it, we've seen it for years, and, you know, in ECW it was there a Sabu one?
Yeah,
you know, and it's just like, I don't think there's really many other, like, you wouldn't go to like an Eagles concert and then someone come out and say, oh, well, they're not here, but, you know, instead we've got the Kinks, you know. It's sort of, it's only in wrestling, you know. Yeah, that could be literally the line for tonight's show in the film. Only in wrestling, you know.
That's what we should have called this series. Yeah, God damn it.
Well, I said, I thought like wrestling and porn are like the two seediest businesses unto themselves in the world.
And if it's Rob Black, you've got both.
More on him shortly.
Sorry, China came back into mind. But it's, yeah, just as you said, yeah, anytime, like, it doesn't matter whether it's like an indie promotion or whether it's like something like the WWF or so on. Anytime that they advertise a guy and that guy doesn't show up and they bring someone else in. I said it before, but Savio fucking Vega.
Yeah, that was a bad one too. Hardcore1283 on WrestlingForum.com says, the way Fabulous Moolah used to run things when she was managing talent in the women's division back in the 80s and early 90s, and possibly further back than that, but I've only ever heard about the 80s and 90s. The story goes, she was basically the agent for just about every female wrestler in the business, and she would do shit like pocket the majority of their pay for herself and actually pimp out the women to promoters just to get the women on the card for shows. There's lots of scummy stories about Moolah like that. Batco 10 from Wrestling Forum also says, anything Moolah did pales in comparison to the exploits of one of the biggest scumbags in wrestling history, Billy Wolf. While not excusing any of Moolah's less than stellar conduct, in my opinion, knowing what a dirtbag operation women's wrestling was under Wolf, she figured the best defense was an offense, and she did unto others before they could do unto her. Wolf was the big cheese in women's wrestling in the 30s, 40s to the mid 50s. By the time he joined the NWA in 1949, he ran a large stable of women's wrestlers who made him a wealthy man. He was married three times, his third wife being the greatest of all time female wrestler, Mildred Burke. Wolf cheated on Burke with the female wrestlers in his troupe every chance he got, and, with the help of the NWA, ruined Mildred's wrestling promotion that she started after her divorce from that philandering piece of shit. However, Wolf sunk to his lowest level when he used his influence with the Georgia State Athletic Commission to get a shield to referee the World Championship match between the title holder Burke and Wolf's daughter-in-law, June Byers, in Atlanta in 1954. After the first fall, which Burke lost intentionally, the match became a shoot. The time limit ran out in the second fall, and Byers was declared the winner and the new champion despite the fact she'd only won one fall in a 2 out of 3 fall match. After 19 years as undefeated women's wrestling champion, Mildred Burke was cheated out of her title by, in my opinion, one of the biggest scumbags in the history of the game, Billy Wolf.
Straight up pimp.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I think that goes...
Great stuff there, though. I like that. Yeah, thank you very much, Mike.
I never knew any of that. That was interesting.
Yeah, it goes to show about the sexism in wrestling, dating back through the decades there. There's the abuse of acting as agents on behalf of the women, and, you know, just very interesting.
Encourage, like, obviously what they're trying to do with women's wrestling now, where they're trying to push forwards with this, because I kind of want to move away from what's happened with women in the past, in terms of whether it's like objectification in the attitude or what you said, or any of this stuff that this chap has mentioned now. None of that I knew about, so that was a very useful history lesson from that chap, so thank you for that. But just like, it's just, we can only know so much from our side of things, but to like, we don't really know what it's like for kind of women in that industry at any point, whether we're talking like the 50s all the way through Attitude Era and even to now, what it must be like for them to work in this kind of business when there's a certain sense of biasness from people who are running it. Would it be fair to say that the business as a whole is scummy towards women?
I think the lesson we've learned through all of these, or for a lot of them, is that promoters and to a large degree talent will do anything for the money, for a buck, and it depending on what era you're running. Attitude Era, a perfect example, as we said with Sable, if that's what people want, if that's what they'll pay for, then they'll exploit them to that level. Maybe to a degree, is that any different to men? It's just that male wrestling fans don't want to, you know, they want something different from men. If males are your key demographic, then you cater to your demographic. Yeah, it's the nature of the scummy side of the business, doing whatever it takes for, to get, you know, to draw a crowd.
Again, another porn parallel there in terms of... Hey. Stevie Richards is good on the FOW board, says, this super shitty company called Chicago All-Star Wrestling booked a barbed wire match featuring a wrestler called the German Superman and billed it as the Concentration Camp Death Match. Which is the first time I've ever heard of something so completely ridiculous. I don't really think there's much more to elaborate on that one other than just mentioning that it existed.
It was the opponent, Raven.
Don't know about that. Poor Heyman.
Every time I hear like something like something German related in wrestling, I always think of that fucking story that CM Punk says in his shoot interview with Samoa Joe, where they talk about like an idea that they had batted around for Heidenreich.
Oh, the frozen Nazi gimmick.
Yeah, the frozen Nazi gimmick where
Dan Madigan was the guy that came up with this fucking awful idea.
So just in brief, if people haven't seen that shoot interview, Foley told them that an idea that they had batted around for Heidenreich was that he was going to be a Nazi frozen in time, right? But not a Nazi as in the Hitler, saluting Adolf Hitler's kind of Nazi, but like as in what the Nazis originally were, which is a political party. So he's going to be a political party Nazi frozen in time who gets thawed out in modern day, and so now he's wrestling with the swastika on. He's always say, "Hey, I'm a Nazi guy," and doesn't understand why everybody's booing him.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
This was Dan Madigan's idea, and if I'm not mistaken, he actually got up and started goose-stepping around the room in the meeting where he's trying to explain this to Vince. And Vince looked at him, he looked around the room, he got up, he took his briefcase, and he just walked out without saying goodbye.
No,
was he on his way to a police station in Pennsylvania?
I'm so gutted I'm not on the ball like you.
It's just... I think that just says a lot about the ignorance of Dan Madigan to not really appreciate the context of Nazis and Nazism and what its true roots were. Obviously, I could have...
Biden the Third Reich.
Yeah, I could...
Oh, God!
No, he could have had, like, the grandson of Hitler as his manager. It'd been amazing.
Rob Lloyd on the Facebook page says, I'm going to go for the ultimate warrior love from the last few years that we are still currently experiencing. 2005, where the WWE wanted to do a documentary on the career of the warrior. However, Hellwig refused to participate, so WWE flips its angle and decides to ridicule the warrior. Whether it was money, his professionalism, his in-ring ability, or promo style, WWE had people lining up to bury the guy. Now, fast forward to 2014, where WWE inducted Hellwig into the Hall of Fame. Unfortunately, he dies within 48 hours of this, and then the stomach-churning glorification of Warrior's career by WWE begins, labelling him one of the greatest WWE champions of all time, the creation of the Warrior Award for future Hall of Fame inductees, and the casting of a life-size bronze statue. I just find it hypocritical that they were burying the guy 1 minute and championing his career the next. Obviously, the WWE has thought about how much merchandise they can sell emblazoned with Warrior's logo on, now the guy is no longer around to protest. Sickening.
Particularly highlighted as well, they in need of, you know, their legends with, you know, they can't mention Hogan anymore and they choose not to mention Savage. So they always need their icon poster boys, and yeah, the hypocritical nature goes about, you know, much explanation really. But gee, I mean, you're somebody who puts a lot more emphasis on the Hall of Fame importance than I do. I rightfully see it as the bullshit it is. what's your view on this?
This is particularly the better example of pretty much something that's been happening with WWF for a long time now. This kind of bipolar kind of treatment of all of its stars. If they're in favour, man, that company is behind you. If you're out of favour, they try and bury you as much as you can. And you can name almost anyone that's passed through that company that's a big name. And those big names have either been in favour or they haven't been in favour, and they've decided to different degrees of how much they've tried to turn the screw on them. You know, if it's something like Screwjob of Brett, or whether it's that Screwjob of the self destruction of Ultimate Warrior, there's something so small but still of the same ilk when like Austin decided to kind of quit and they do that, the little dig, you know,
take the ball and go home stuff.
No matter what it is, who they are, if they're out of favour, it's turn the screw on them. But then as soon as, like, you know, business pops back up again, everything's fine and dandy. I think this is just probably the most sickening version of it, where it's someone who he's one of the most notoriously screwed over guys in that company, in terms of like the company berating him or whatever, like alongside like Macho Man, and you could probably say Bret Hart for a good period of time, where basically they took any opportunity they could to bury the guy. And then as soon as they saw money figures and the possibility of, you know, they can get some cash from the guy, they decide suddenly they're best friends again. And I think that's, it's the hypocritical nature of the business, and also just how Vince sees some of these acts.
You know what it is? I've got a great phrase. It's pro wrestling racketeering. It's like Vince is like the mafia, and it's like, if you're on our side, if you're paying us, are you making me money doing exactly what I want? You know, we'll protect you, wink. If you're not, we're going to fucking burn your shop down.
Fake plastic trees on Pro Wrestling Only says the WWF sex scandals of the early 90s is really up there in terms of WWE scummy behind the scenes history. WWE in general just comes off as a let's suppress this type of corporation, which is why the racism, sexism, etc. has flourished for so many years. I don't think we'll harp on this one too much, because I think there's a future show on these scandals and ones of this ilk that we might get to in the not-too-distant future. So we'll save discussion on that for another time. Devontae Swing from WrestlingForum.com says, 1 year at a Brian Pillman Memorial Show, Kevin Nash showed up, got drunk, pledged he would write a $20,000 check to Pillman's wife if Missy Hyatt, who came to every show, would take her top off. Hyatt noted the audience was filled with young children and was mad that it was even suggested and refused to do so. Nash agreed at the show to write the check anyway, but then sobered up and changed his mind.
He's a man of his word, I guess. He said he'd do it
for the titties.
No, don't.
No, I'm going to stop.
Yeah. Big Kev being Big Kev. We talked about Ian Rotten previously, and this is one of the incidents that Ian Rotten was a part of. Kaz Hayashi from the UK Fan Forum says, the IWA incident where a number of wrestlers and a child came out to beat the fuck out of Mike Levy. A kicking is shit, but not scares. However, several wrestlers kicking the fuck out of him in front of a crowd is both shit and highly disturbing. From what I remember, it was due to a botched spot. Matthew Allen Hanso on TPWW also says, Ian Rotten and his redneck drones helping beat that one guy after his match with Mickey Knuckles in some hardcore crap in a gas station parking lot. The guy was like some fat, untrained loser, and they used it as a chance to try and put themselves over and shoot on some loser. Hearn's son from the UK Fan Forum says the Mike Levy incident also stands out. In fact, Ian Rotten in general makes me feel sick and depressed just looking at him. Project Nim on the UK Fan Forum says, add me to those saying the Mike Levy incident. I initially heard about this on a forum, then watched video footage of it. Bothered me for some time afterwards, just awful. This is
perked up right away. Yeah, I love a good bit of being there. I've seen it, and yeah, it's horrendous.
Real like, cockfight atmosphere to it, you know?
Yeah, horrible. Just like the worst part of it is, what's the old joke? I used to like it when the marks are in the stands. You can't tell a flying fuck who is who. Like, you can't tell who are supposed to be these wrestlers who are beating him up, who is the crowd who is just cheering it on. Like, literally, you would not be able to tell apart unless you knew who the people were. It's just awful, you know. Yeah, I say, if you haven't seen it, look it up, but I really wouldn't.
No, it's not worth watching. No. It's honestly, actually, I want to skip past it. I've got to acknowledge it because some of the listeners want to talk about it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But honestly, if you're one of those rednecks in the crowd cheering for this weird spectacle, fuck you.
Yeah.
You're an idiot.
Yeah.
However, we move along from Ian Rotten to another person who Paul Siebert wanted to nominate as a potential king scumbag. XPW promoter Rob Black, aka pornographer Rob Sicari, who was eventually arrested and pled guilty to obscenity charges on a country where selling pornography is perfectly legal. But before you write him off as some kind of free speech martyr, trust me, his company was that bad. Among his many crimes against wrestling fans, however, include using the XPW television as a means of getting Extreme Associates porn stars on television, introducing the world to Pogo the Clown, a wrestler based on serial killer John Wayne Gacy, filming an angle where Pogo the Clown abducted children, filming an angle where Pogo the Clown offered the Sandman's son candy, doing a death match where porn star Victoria Crane had to set a table on fire, and since she'd never done anything like this before, she put too much lighter fluid on the table, the resulting blaze resulted in Wrestler Supreme being set on fire. Also, ringside security immediately put the table out and ignored Supreme, who ran around the ring flailing his arms around while he was ablaze. Putting New Jack and Vic Grimes in a dangerously high scaffold match that almost killed Vic Grimes, and wanting to film a dog being eaten by a python for a weirdo fetish site. Then, after the authorities were notified, Black tried to turn it into a wrestling angle where he was allegedly assaulted by the LAPD, and finally allegedly hiring a pair of armed goons to beat up and cut off the thumb of Wrestler Messiah. Another rap sheet there. Actually, they were trying to get his thumbs in his dick, wasn't the story? And then there was enough commotion made that they just fleed and they just settled for the thumb.
It was something to that effect, yeah. I mean, the rap sheet would have been bad enough if it was just Rob Black for creating XPW.
Yeah.
Because we talk about, you know, we've talked before about ECW and sort of the almost the smoke and mirrors element and how much credit has to go to Paul Heyman for making something seem bigger than it was. You've got XPW, which is just a complete knockoff that couldn't look shitter if they tried. You know, if shit is what they aspired to, I don't think they could have done better than this. It's, you know, we don't need to go through every incident there, but, you know, there's enough terrible ones, almost paedophilia elements, which is beyond the pale. He employed New Jack, you know, add that to the list. After ECW, put him in a scaffold match with Vic Grimes, bearing in mind what had happened at Living Dangerously 2000 between Vic Grimes and New Jack. It's just, it's a porn guy masquerading as a wrestling promoter.
Yeah, there's a common theme of getting rid of these now, with these talentless, clueless, classless marks trying to create a product because they're marks themselves, and they just don't know what they're doing. There's no class to it. There's no
art.
There's no art to it. There's no psychology to it. Half of the stuff, more than half the stuff, most of the stuff. It's just, you know, it's fucking, it's an embarrassment to the wrestling business, really.
Couldn't agree more. Gay as Fook on the UK fan forum says, for me, nothing comes close. That time it was insinuated that DX gang raped a girl. You don't remember? That's cool. Most people don't. It was during their fall of 99 till from merry pranksters to evil scumbags. I can't remember the exact date, but there was a Raw in November where the closing of the show contained a segment where DX, who had been pursuing Stephanie all evening, dragged a helpless girl into a locker room and shut the door, cackling like a pack of old boyos on the tear. The show closes, as I recall, with Vince helplessly banging on the door, screaming for his daughter. This also being before Steph's onset of actual amnesia, which he fell victim to after the bulldog fucked a bin at her head to see if his title shot was inside it. In the immediate aftermath, it's been made clear to the viewers that it wasn't Stephanie, but that still leaves open the question of who this girl was. The one saving grace of today's WWE is that despite always wearing the philanthropy as self-fellatio hat, the angles have been mostly above board for years now in terms of moral conduct, and the locker room actually does seem like it's full of some pretty alright people.
You know what's fucked up about that is they did this angle and they didn't want to give the impression that Stephanie got raped, because that's a horrible thought. But they'll still do it with someone else, because yeah, if it's a faceless broad, who cares? So they know their own stuff's bullshit and tasteless and unacceptable, but they go ahead of it anyway because it wasn't Stephanie, so it's alright.
Yeah, it's a bit like the sort of the reverse Fritz von Erich, isn't it, in the sense of, you know, Fritz did these things with his sons because, you know, if anyone has the right to profit off it, it's me at the end of the day. They were my sons, whereas obviously this is Vince. Well, you want to do this, I'm not going to do it with my daughter, though. Oh, God, no, that's far too horrific. Have we still got Ryan Shamrock under employment?
Simon Warden on the UK Fan Forum says, Canyon was thrown to the floor from the triple cage at Slamboree 2000 about a year on from Owen Hart's death in the same arena, the same town. Surely there were plenty of fans that night who had watched the man fall to his death a year before who didn't particularly want to see a big bump like that ever again. I reckon in Kansas there must still be a few people with fears of the arena and going anywhere near it thinking their prince will cause a man to fall from a great height. Around a month later, WCW did another big bump again with a Sting stunt double as well.
And pray tell, just who happened to be booking WCW at that point?
Vince Russo, who Roddy Piper alleges killed Owen Hart. But this is one of those ones where I just strike that up to just cluelessness.
Yeah.
It's scummiest. They weren't thinking this. They were just too stupid to think of it.
No, well, part of my sort of insinuation in asking the question is obviously it's Russo. He's a moron. Is it one of those things you'd call really offensive? Probably not, in the sense that they were idiots, so it wasn't deliberate, but it's I go back to that word, uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to see, and you can tell from the reaction of the 17 that actually paid to go to the show and the about 6,000 others that turned up to the Kemper Arena, the sort of the quiet hush that you get from it whilst Schiavone and Hudson and the like are doing the hard sell. It's self-evident watching it that it's, yeah, these fans aren't reacting how you want. They're just, it's a stunned silence, and like I say, just an uncomfortable nature all round.
Do you think that was them doing like a big spot with Canyon like that? Do you think that was their kind of counterpoint, because Foley did a big bump and No Way Out? So it's like, oh, we're doing a cage match, so we've got to do big bump because Foley did one at No Way Out and it was big.
Was that
the reason they did it, and not because they were like, oh, we can do it like it was Owen Hart?
Yeah, of course it was a big bump for the sake of a big bump. It's Russo's thing. Then we'll just throw you off the cage. Well, yeah, they padded the ramp and all that stuff, but it's just a big bump for the sake of a big bump.
I suppose the one thing you could possibly argue against them is the fact that they got enough, not like sort of mainstream negative publicity, but enough people raised it immediately afterwards, and, you know, look what you've done, and the fact they carried on with it afterwards, you mentioned about, yeah, they had Foley took the big bump, but that, you know, that wasn't tied into anything. It was just, it was part of an incident in that match which led to Foley's, at the time, quote unquote retirement. Whereas this, they had Kanyon in the hospital, they had DDP visiting him, they had Kanyon in a wheelchair with a halo. The incident itself, yeah, I don't chalk that up as being offensive. I just chalk that up to them being clueless. But they maybe, you know, they had the opportunity to pull back after that and didn't. And that's, again, I don't want to use the word scummy, almost seems like the wrong word to use, but it's a bit tactless.
Yeah. Mike Campbell on Pro Wrestling Owner says, the Larry Sweeney, Bobby Dempsey, Alison Danger, Ring of Honor angle deserves mention as well. The angle was that Bobby Dempsey was the fat member of Sweet and Sour Incorporated, and Larry Sweeney, who was great, knocked out Alison Danger and then tried to get Bobby Dempsey to, it's time to be a man, Bobby. It's time for you to step up and pretty much insinuate they're going to rape this unconscious girl. And then Larry Sweeney then knocked out Bobby Dempsey, who landed on top of Alison Danger. And it was awful. It was pretty stupid. What makes it worse, and it's actually, it ties back to the Trish angle, is the crowd reaction. That's what makes it seem so much more sleazy and scummy than it really is. Because like the Trish angle, they went fucking crazy and thought this was hilarious that this was happening to the woman, kind of a thing. And they weren't probably thinking that way consciously, but it's just that, you know, this is wildly entertaining. And that frames these kind of angles worse than they already are. So I think that's kind of why this one gets mentioned.
Yeah, and just on a bit of an aside, a bit like, you know, the... Well, I think I've ragged on enough ECW fans over the years, but these ROH fans as well, you sort of look at them and they like to give the impression, especially during this period and through the infancy of ROH, like, they're above that sort of thing. We're the, you know, the pure wrestling company. We have the pure title. We're above all this. Like the ECW fans, we're the renegades. We're cool. We buy front row tickets to see Sid win the world title. You know, these Ring of Honor fans, you really cast them in a bit of a more negative light, let's say. You know, they're holier than thou. You know, better than the rest of us.
Getting to the last nomination from you, the loyal listeners here, and it had to be mentioned. Tiger Rick on the UK Fan Forum says, it's not the worst ever, but it's fresh in my mind because I watched it last year and then again yesterday. Everything involving Rey Mysterio between Eddie Guerrero dying and WrestleMania 22, it's truly horrible. At best, it's the most misguided attempt at a tribute ever, and at worst, it's a cold, calculating attempt to make money off a real-life tragedy. The Royal Rumble is vomit-inducing, and how the fuck Rey Mysterio was able to justify to himself performing that skit where he looks up to heaven and accuses Eddie of playing tricks on him for getting a low number in the Royal Rumble, I'll never know. Then he performs Eddie's entrance. I want to poke my eyes out by this point. It gets worse, though, on the road to WrestleMania, when they've discovered that this angle is horrible and cold, so they heat it up with Randy Orton cutting that atrocious promo claiming Eddie's in hell. It's not even a case after that of wanting to see the heel get his comeuppance. It's crossing a horrible line that takes you right out of the moment and reminds you that this is a fake, scummy shit. They'd make a buck by prostituting their dead nan if they could. That Ray is the one to dedicate all this guff to Eddie is even more laughable given Eddie's actual nephew is on the roster. That just hammers home how much of it is a money decision. There'll be mentions of Brody and Benoit and Snooker that are worse, but this is horrible. But this did get some support. Mr. Showtime on the UK Fan Forum also says, the incident that winds me up the most about all of this is Eddie's car getting basically blown up, insinuating that The Undertaker has been vanquished. This happened 11 days after Eddie's death. WH1007 on the UK Fan Forum says, the Eddie Guerrero stuff is probably the worst thing they've ever done. It's not as if they even waited. They had Randy Orton try to kill The Undertaker using one of Eddie's lowriders a week after he died. It only got worse once Ray got involved. Big Vic from TPWW also just said Randy Orton's character after the death of Eddie Guerrero. And Tanis Sarwe from Pro Wrestling Only says, from Triple H and Orton saying that Eddie is not in heaven but is in hell, to trying to make Mysterio a top guy using Guerrero's name every single second, even though everybody under the sun knows that Rey Mysterio needs no one to get over. The whole situation during that time made me question why I'm still watching this. It was cheap heat, it was piss poor booking, and they've known better. Happy New Year, guys! So a lot of discussion there. This was the one that Luke Edwards, our partner in crime here at Squared Circle Gazette Radio, did vote for his scummiest moment ever when he was asked about this on the Christmas show. So, thoughts on this?
Well, I think it's fair to say that it's one, if not the first, it's one of the first deaths that I think we all felt sort of quite raw about around this table in terms of wrestling deaths. Because we were all of an age where we were old enough to sort of appreciate, if you like, and digest what had happened and sort of the shock of it all. And obviously you get the Raw tribute show, which really brings that point home as well. It sort of spirals so very quickly from the tribute into the storylines, and as one of the emailers said there, you know, you can't get away from the real life event, and it sort of just it dredges up a real sort of a real sadness at any point it's used during the TV time, a general sadness, at least me, and I'm sure with the rest of you. And it's almost as if they know that it's not working from the fan reaction, but they just can't bring themselves to pull back from it, you know, to the point where, you know, fans start to boo Ray. By the time you've, you know, obviously we go through the Orton saying he's in hell, and you know the way that Ray's basically won the Royal Rumble being consumed by the spirit of Eddie Guerrero, it would seem, the way they play it up, to the point where when you get to Mania during that triple threat, the only person that those fans want to see walking out with the world title is Kurt Angle.
Yeah,
you know, they don't care about Orton at any point. They find the Eddie stuff tied in with Ray uncomfortable, so it doesn't get Ray over, doesn't get Orton over, and then they're eventually pissed because Angle doesn't win anyway.
Yeah,
and then, you know, that's bad enough. By the time we get to SummerSlam, and Chavo is then involved
as the heel,
and it's still the Eddie side, and then you bring Vicky in, and it just, like I say, it just sort of it spirals. And it's bad TV all round anyway.
It didn't even end there, because remember they had like Benoit interview with Chavo over, yeah, Eddie's estate.
Yeah, to win, you know, to win the US title, I think, eventually off Chavo, and it's all really uncomfortable. And it's a bit like, I think when we used the Melanie Pillman analogy after Brian had died, sort of like you want the company to take care of them and just write them a check. Now absolutely, you know, and the Vicky Guerrero character obviously worked on TV, got the reaction that Vicky was going for, and she, you know, bless her, she tried her hardest with it, but all the while I'm just thinking, don't parade her out on TV like this. Maybe she's happy to be, maybe she's comfortable being there. I think she's referenced before about how it was part of earning money to put the kids through their college education, which is all very commendable, but you just think, brings back bad memories, write the woman a check and make sure the family are taken care of.
It's just that same mentality we've gone over before when we're talking about Melanie, where it's just like, look, in Vince's mind, he signed a contract, okay? He signed a contract, so he works for me. And even in death, he works for me. If he has any friends, they still work for me. I'll still use his name. He's got a wife, I'll bring her in. They all work for me. That's just Vince's mentality, and it always will be. And it's just, this I put in the exact same barrel as Brian Pillman. So if I find the use of Melanie Pillman offensive, I find this offensive. And yeah, again, it's that whole thing, is it's like, it wasn't even like something that they did maybe like a year down the line, like a year anniversary kind of thing. It was right after. It was like, it's that thing of opportunistic mentality. Go, hey, someone died, we could still use this. And it's just like, it's that mentality that I hate. I mean, like, And the guy who wrote in, I think it was the last guy who wrote in, was right. It was like, Ray didn't need that sort of thing to get over. You know, Ray Mysterio, he was a great talent himself. The Vicky Guerrero aspect of it, I have the utmost respect for Vicky Guerrero, because she must have been put into such a hard situation. I couldn't imagine they would have been financially secure at the time of Eddie Guerrero's death, and I agree with you guys. I think they should have definitely like wrote a check and just went, look, here you go. I hope this will be enough for whatever. But I admire Vicky Guerrero for what she did. I admire that she had no, as far as I was aware, no experience of the wrestling industry at all. But she had to sit down and go, look, I've got children, I've got a family to look after. I've been given an opportunity here to do something, to earn money. And so she did that, and you know, it took a while for her to kind of get into that world, but I thought by the end of it she kind of grew into it, and she became quite a good performer in terms of getting the heat. I mean, still remember that Raw where she's in the ring with Dolph and John Cena, and the crowd just fucking despised her and everything. It's just like, I thought she was really good, and I respect her because, yeah, she earned the money so she can get her kids through college, and also on top of that, she earned money so she could get through college as well, and she got a degree, I think it was in business or something like that. So that's why she left because she goes, I've done everything I need to, I can now move on with my life and do something else. In terms of the absolute horribleness of pimping out Eddie's legacy, and his I do take sort of happiness in the fact that Vicky Guerrero was able to kind of move through that shit field basically and get something kind of good out of it, which is basically a future for both her and her family.
Yeah, I said before that the Eddie death was, and it still is really, the only wrestler death that's really been upsetting to me, that's actually affected me.
Yeah.
You know, before and after, it's sad a guy's died, even like Dusty and stuff, it's sad, but it happens. Eddie was generally upsetting, and to see them see the direction they went, it was just, it didn't sit well with me. Every time I saw Ray do that shimmy,
yeah, I hate it every time.
Every time, man.
JBL trying to do it for heat was just as bad.
Yeah. But the one thing, being Ray, I wouldn't put it past him. Like, this is an idea to fucking sabotage his career. Oh no, this will help you, Ray. Yeah, no, they'll fucking hate you after this. Yeah. We'll have to push you again after we've gotten through this shit.
Yeah.
I never sat well with me. I wouldn't put it in the class as Melanie Pillman. I mean, it was the night after. She's like, fucking doesn't know what day it is.
Yeah.
And as we said before, they advertise it throughout the show as a ratings ploy, and then just fucking, mentally raped her. It was fucking TV rape.
Emotional rape.
For what? For their own little disclaimer and pop a rating as a bonus. That's much worse for me.
Yeah, when Eddie died, everybody kind of took it hard anyway. It's like, this is so obviously a situation you need to treat delicately, and then they just completely decided not to instead.
Well, that's the thing. You could have done it if you'd done it subtly. I hadn't actually mentioned it, and then Ray's going for the title, and he just
mentions
one
it
last thing.
On the night, yeah,
yeah. It, that's, no one had a problem with that. People would have loved that stuff.
Yeah.
And that's fine. In context, it's a similar thing. It's the context and the execution and the delicacy of it. It's just,
Yeah, I think for around the table, everyone's just kind of hit on all the major points that I wanted to. The only thing I take away from it is that ultimately I think it is quite nice that Vicky was able to get into the business, take from it, and get out alive, sane. Relatives, especially some of the shit she went through, they did on TV and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And actually, she raked the business back a little bit, got some money out of it, paid for her life, sorted her kids out. Like we all say, she should never have had to do it, but actually, I always think one person that came across quite similar was Charmel, wasn't she? Just like in law school or business school or something like that.
Yeah.
Just literally did it to get some more money out of the company, to earn a living. And I think that it's possibly it's where maybe the wives probably fare a little better because they're not marks for the business like the boys are, so like they can actually come in and just go, I'll turn up at this time because that's when I'm needed for the show, I'll go home, because she had to still be raising these two girls through all of this time, so she kind of been like on the, I assume she didn't do house shows and stuff like that. Bravo to her for doing it, but bad taste all round on the stuff after Eddie's shit.
So that has pretty much stretched the gamut on tasteless scummy moments. We have unfortunately run out of time. While we have all of us around the table for this situation, final votes after these two shows, scummiest moment in wrestling history around the table.
Still Melanie Pillman for me.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Carl?
It's a little bit more difficult after the Brody one, but yeah, I'd still say the Pillman situation.
In terms of scummiest person, New Jack, in terms of the ones that we've gone over, I was lean towards Melanie, but I think the Brody ones kind of convinced me. On a personal note, in terms of like ones that I immediately thought of, the one that came straight to mind, it hasn't been mentioned, and actually it kind of, you could maybe argue saying you couldn't include it because it never actually happened. It was more just an idea that Vince had that never came to fruition. It was when Steph was pregnant with the spawn of Hunter, and they were trying to decide like, right, how are we going to explain how she's pregnant if like in storyline wise these two are divorced? So Vince had the superb idea of deciding, why don't we do an angle where the baby's mine?
That's just him living out his fantasies, dude.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, but and that's why when looking at like scummy, what like a definition of scummy is, that's what kind of was blaring at me, because it was just like, so first off, this was completely needless, because like, who gives a shit if she turns up pregnant on Raw? People who know she's still with Triple H still know, and people who don't know, who gives a shit? Because hey, but it's also that thing of like oh, God forbid that the audience for 1 minute think like, oh well, she was a bit slutty and just slept with some guy and got pregnant. No, we must explain it. I know, incest. That's going to be the line. And it's just the thing that gets me why I concentrate on that as scummy is because it's like, what guy would actively think of an idea of incest with his daughter, because I'm thinking like
Grizzly Smith.
Well, yeah, I guess so. Because how are they going to sell that angle? How are they going to show it that this type of thing was happening?
They wouldn't. They'd just allude to it. That's all.
They'd allude to it, but what would they have done?
They're not going
to
show you a sex tape, are they?
Well, I don't know. No. It's fucking this man.
I was like,
how are they going to portray this to the audience without it just being like,
no. It works in Game of Thrones, though, so, you know.
Well, yeah. And just for that, it's just Vince. That's just wrong. That's just horrible. It's like the fact that, if you watch a documentary, you can see in Steph's eyes, she's just kind of like shitting hell. Yeah. It's like, really? It's like, yeah. When you first asked me that, that was the first thing that came to mind.
Of course, he wants to fuck her in real life. She's a female Vince McMahon. It's Vince fucking himself with a big pair of fake titties. Of course he wants to. Yeah.
Halty, your nomination for scummiest moment here as we wrap it up.
Yeah, it's tough to go with anything other than the Melanie Pillman one. I think the examination of the Vicky Guerrero, we say, well, she got to win in the end. You know, the Brody one is so difficult, I remain partly quiet on it. He was part of the business. You know, there is no redemption in the Melanie Pillman stuff. It's just, she never really got to reap any benefits from what they did there. It was just, you know, absolutely horrendous.
Yeah, Melanie Pillman is right up there. I still lean towards Joey McDivitt and the WWE trying to blame the Benoit child murder on a condition that we don't know if it ever really did exist. So yeah, I think that's pretty low. But what we've learned over these two podcasts is that, man, there's a lot of shit in wrestling.
It's a dirty
business. Is a dirty, dirty business. So thank you very much for everybody who's written. Thank you very much across the oaken table here for all of these contributions. We will be back next week to discuss the Royal Rumble that's taking place this Sunday, as well as WrestleMania and beyond. We're going to take a look at current events in the world of WWE and the current state of play as we get ready for WrestleMania 32.
Can't be any worse than last fucking year.
Well, let's not jump the gun, because they can always. We said the same thing last year.
Can't be.
So, thank you very much for listening. Thank you for being a part of it. And again, thank you for all the nominations for Best Podcast of the Year for G. John Chase.
Hunt that little shit down and get me my detonators.
For Matt Holt.
Maybe we could work a Luke Harper channeling Bruiser Brody Royal Rumble entry.
For Kieran O'Rourke.
R.I.P. Vince Gruber.
And for Carl Jones.
The vote may have been close, but Austin, there will be no recount. That award is ours.
Yeah, I like how he's done the job was twice in the course of this competition.
Oh yeah,
the
nominations.
Qualifiers and the final.
Yeah.
It's like two more jobs than he did for Brockers. Thanks, Stone Cold.
I am Lee Rourke and we are out of here. Talk to you next week. I'm too hot for you, yo. Latino heat.
Coming from the streets of the ghetto, at the end of the week, I get to keep your dinero. You're fast asleep when I sneak in your casa. Your life sucks, cause you're bankrupt and I'm laughing. Can't trust me, answer, cause I'm Latin. I lie, I cheat, I steal.
Do you feel it?
I lie, I cheat, I steal. Yeah. Say hello to Eddie.
Yo.
Too many try to tell me what I already know.
Yo.
Can you feel the heat?
Yeah.
Say hello.
Yo.
Yeah. Viva la raza.